Domestic tapes were found by midnight tonight. The consequences will be very serious.
What sort of impression have you got so far from the people who've had a preview of the film?
I'm not going to say too much, you know, I don't want to count my chickens, but it looks like a good reaction so far.
This movie is a real disgrace. I give it one star. I'm Roger Ebert.
Welcome to Revolution 2
through 8.
Hey, Dylan.
Hey, Zach.
In Beatles news events, we did learn in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that Marvel believes that Ringo Starr sold his soul to Mephisto, and that's how he became famous. And in other Beatles-related news, there is a Beatles box set that we will have to cover called Johnny Yoko, Plastic Ono Band, Power to the People. It covers a lot of live stuff from the sometime New York City era.
It's mostly live, right?
Yeah, mostly live. Some demos, outtakes, jam, home recordings, additional live performances. It's compiled by Sean Lennon, hot by mixing of Paul Hicks. I'm on superdeluxeedition.com, so that's where I'm getting all this. audio restoration by San Gannon, and mixes Master to Abbey Road by Alex Wharton. Yeah, so, I mean, we'll eventually cover this box set in some shape or form. I mean, we kind of have to.
When we get around to it.
We still have to cover Mind Games and all 5,000 tracks that are on Mind Games. It is our mind game whale. What's going on with you?
I, got some antiquing done in between sessions, picked up a bunch of records, some of which aren't available on streaming, so I'll be looking to digitize those kind of in my leisure. The exciting thing, of course, is I'm going to go see Ringo Starr.
Really? Me too. We'll have to share notes about that.
We'll have to compare notes.
In my news, I'm back at work because I'm a teacher. I don't know if that will make me a better or worse podcaster.
Take notes on summer Zach versus rest of the time Zach.
Mm-hmm. I have a really sad story to tell. This is not the first time that we have recorded this episode. It's actually the second time.
Yeah.
So let me explain. So we actually were both in the cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Recently, I went to go see Nine Inch Nails, and while we were there, we're like, "Oh, we should record this episode because you have family that lives near the cities." And I'm like, "We should do that for fun. We could finally have an in-person podcast." So we went to a friend's place that had some audio equipment in the cities to record this episode, and we did. And it's probably one of the best episodes we ever done. Really, really good. And so I said to our friend to watch my computer while I was at the concert. Everything was fun. You know, I like Nine Inch Nails. They're pretty fun. I came back from the concert and our friend was missing, and so was my computer. And I'm like, oh no, because what you also don't know is that we have an agency that we have a podcast through because they know how talented we are. We would get in trouble if we didn't turn in the podcast on time.
I took out some real ill-advised loans a couple years back.
Yeah, so this is a big deal because our master files were on my computer and our friend is not picking up the phone, and we don't know where he is.
I told Zach, all right, hop in my hot rod. Mm-hmm. We're going to go around the city. Yep. We're going to find this guy. I think this is just a big misunderstanding. Yeah. I don't think he stole our priceless podcast recording.
Speaking of big, we ran into a wrestler named The Big Show. He's part of the agency that we're part of. And he's like, hey, you know, your podcast master recordings are worth $1 billion. And I'm like, yeah, we know that already.
We're awesome.
We can't take that deal, Big Show. And he's like, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, but have you seen your friend? He's like, no, I haven't. You know, I used to know this guy. Back in the day, he could have been a good wrestler, but he decided to go straight. And I'm like, yeah, he could have been a good wrestler. That's really it. We weren't able to find him. We have Interpol, MI6, the FBI, CIA.
We're a big deal. You know, it'd be really funny if he was just like stuck in one of the rain shelters at the light rail station this whole time. We don't know. That would be preposterous.
We weren't able to find him. So, yeah, so we had to re-record this. So you won't get a podcast recording in person. It'll eventually happen. I'm sorry, fans. Damn, it sucks. We had some good stuff in there.
If you find that laptop anywhere, please return it to us. We're worried sick.
I don't think our friend like also contacted The Big Show as well, but if I ever get in contact with The Big Show again, he's not returning my calls either. It's a mess. So you're like wondering what happened to us. Well, we're just getting paid less. Just have to keep putting out more of these podcasts.
We're under like a really bad agency contract now.
Yeah, sadly.
It's boring bureaucracy stuff. You don't really care. Don't don't worry about it.
I don't think we should have trusted a guy named Bad Businessman for the contract.
I don't know why we trusted a man in a top hat and monocle, a handlebar mustache in the year 2025. He looks like a Victorian era villain.
He does. But what can he do?
You know, he's very charismatic.
He like never talks.
That's the most charismatic thing about him.
He also has a sword cane, which you also have.
Yeah.
It wasn't a dream.
No. Definitely not a flimsy premise to a bad movie.
Yeah. Speaking of dreams, I had a dream that Paul McCartney wrote a movie. Ringo was also in this movie, and it was a pun about the song Give My Regards to Broadway, and it is about Give My Regards to Broad Street.
Zach, I don't think that was a dream. I think Paul actually did that.
What? He did?
I think in the 80s, Paul was like, I'm so cool, I'm going to make a movie.
We know. This is a joke. We know that he totally made a movie. That first part of this, when we were talking about how the second time we record this, that wasn't a joke. That was real. So we've watched this movie.
I think you may have watched this movie more than anybody else has on this planet.
We actually watched this together twice when I was back in Fargo. I watched it one more time when we were in the cities together, of course. So I've like watched this movie at least once a week since we watched it together. And I watched it today at double speed because I wanted to remember everything from this movie, because there's a lot to remember in this movie. This is a very well... the plot of this movie is tight. It is. Don't laugh. It is a very tight movie. Like, it's really good. The soundtrack of this movie is really weird. There's a short that plays before this movie that we're going to talk about right now. That's about this character called Rupert that we know nothing about.
It's a very British, like British childhood animation.
It's like a bad Paddington.
A little bit.
But that Rupert thing is interesting. Paul voices the character. I think Paul may have some recordings about Rupert that we might go look into. So we might do like a short episode on the Rupert stuff, or maybe a bigger episode. It played before and it did really well. Like, I think the song charted and actually did really well in the UK.
Yeah, we'll just talk about it very briefly because it preceded the film sort of in the theatrical release. But we'll talk about it in more detail eventually because Paul seemed pretty invested in this Rupert stuff.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he voices the character. He made the song for it.
Rupert the Bear is playing outside, having childhood myrrh and adventure. He finds a cave that says, no bears allowed, only frogs. And he's like, well, this sign can't stop me because I can't read. And he goes and he listens to a secret frog concert. And like, there's like a bird that wants to eat the frogs, but it doesn't get to. And that's pretty much it.
And the most evil animal of all, cats.
Oh yeah, and the cats are there too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, cats can do no wrong, so they're fine.
They're evil.
And then Rupert goes home and tells his mom all about it, and his mom is like, that's nice, dear. Why don't you just shut up, eat your dinner, and go to bed? And that's the short. It's weird to me. I can't speak for British cinema tradition, but the American tradition of an animated short before a feature-length film had more or less died out, I think, by sort of like when Warner Brothers closed their animation shop. You know, we stopped getting like, you know, Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. I think that was like by the 70s. I think it was pretty much over. So having that in the 80s, that might have been like a novelty factor. I don't think that was regular. I don't think that was something that happened often.
I also wonder if because it's like something that's rooted in Paul's childhood.
A lot of the songs talk about childhood.
And it's like a midlife crisis movie. If we want to be really mean right off the bat about this movie.
It very much is. Let's talk about the movie.
Okay, the beginning of this movie kind of starts out, we're in a club and Paul's like, dearly beloved, we are gathered here to get through this thing called Broad Street Station. Electric word, Broad Street Station. It means until 1986, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you something else.
No, Zach, you're mixing up your big blockbuster musician-driven movies from that year.
What?
Prince had a movie in 1984 called Purple Rain. You're thinking of Purple Rain.
What? No, I'm not. Like, it has the song, but it's like, Let's Go Crazy. And that's kind of how this movie begins, right?
Well, the movie begins by Paul going crazy, but no, you're thinking of Prince's epic 1984 Purple Rain, a masterpiece on the Minneapolis sound. No, we got to talk about Paul's movie.
Yeah, so this is Paul's movie. We're gonna just, I want to spoil everything from the outset of this movie
and I'll help.
not a lot happens in this movie, but it's kind of hard to explain. We are here because I find this movie to be kind of funny, and like, because there's like really weird things that bother me. And when I say it's spoiled, this movie, 90% of this movie is a dream. So everything we're about to explain to you doesn't happen, never happened, and it is the most boring execution of a dream I think I have ever experienced. But in that, it's kind of fascinating. Like, the more I watch it, the more intrigued, and I'm like, is this really what Dream Paul is like? Is this what Paul as a dreamer is like? Is this really the story he wanted to tell people? So going further with that, the first scene of this movie, we are in a car in traffic, and a guy is saying,
I know, I know, I know, I know.
The chauffeur, that's like all he says. He's talking to a record executive, Brian, trying to get Paul to the studio. Paul's sitting in traffic, writing big ideas in his notebook, and Good Day Sunshine comes on.
There's this stare that Paul has in the car where it's like his best acting in the whole movie, because there is like an intensity to him where, I hate saying it, it feels like we get Dark Paul for a hot second, where Paul is like, my life is pain. He looks angry that Good Day Sunshine comes on. And apparently, like, part of this movie was developed while he was sitting in traffic in this exact situation. And a lot of the script was kind of written in that burst when he was in traffic that one time. And it's just, yeah, it's just such a weird look, especially because, like, the Paul we get next and the star of the movie, it's not the Hot Rod. This Hot Rod has the most interesting plot line of the whole movie. Like, I had to talk to one of our friends about how confusing this one car is. And you're like, it's a dream. And I'm like, I know. How this Hot Rod gets around fascinates me. I want a movie about how this Hot Rod gets from place to place.
McCartney fully loaded.
And how we never see it, but it appears way later in the movie. But that's not the star. It's the Hawaiian shirt that Paul is wearing. That is the real star.
It's such a good pattern.
Why is Dream Paul wearing a Hawaiian shirt?
Because Paul McCartney thinks he's cool. And how else do you, in 1984, during like kind of the Miami Vice era, like, how do you show you're cool? You wear a Hawaiian shirt.
Do you think like Paul is sad that he just can't go back to that beard Paul? Like, we don't really see like mustache or like beard Paul McCartney. Really? Haven't really seen that since the...
Well, I suspect that, you know, usually your facial hair is the first to go gray. So I bet he ditched that to keep up his boyish young looks.
This beard series is something I had never thought about. That we could have always gotten bearded Paul. Not like Ringo, who's willing to show mortality. Because Ringo does appear in this movie. He also has a funny shirt. He has like a very bizarre outfit.
He's got like a graphic, like...
tee.
Three-quarter baseball kind of tee. But with a vest over it.
And not gonna lie, he looks like he's from the 2000s. Like, it look, I feel like I owned his shirt because it's like a white long sleeve shirt. It almost looks like it could have like skulls on it and stuff.
Yeah.
And he looks kind of edgy. So I love this shirt, this Hawaiian shirt. We can't really find this Hawaiian shirt, which is sad.
No, if you search Give My Regards to Broad Street Hawaiian shirt, what you will find is a shirt for sale with the goddamn album cover printed on it as a Hawaiian shirt. And that is unacceptable. I don't want to wear the Give My Regards to Broad Street album.
The album cover is like Paul having his finger above his lip, looking all quizzical. Then there's like a silhouette of, it must be from the Eleanor Rigby Victorian London sequence.
I suspect and so.
With like the blue shining case, which a director by Quentin Tarantino will be like, well, that's kind of dumb. What if we do the opposite, where the case is normal, but then the inside of it's shiny? And that's what, because Quentin Tarantino, if you go on Wikipedia, it says Quentin Tarantino watched this movie and it's like, oh, I liked this case and how it glowed.
That's not real, is it? You are making that up, surely.
Why are you calling me out? That's like I was trying to give like something to this movie. Shows you haven't done the research on this movie.
I really haven't. I will be completely honest with you. I have done very little research on this movie. I have my own experiences. I've watched this movie a handful of times and I'm not impressed.
Well, as a person that's watched it a lot and it's become like a religion, part of me is going to be sad not to watch it anymore because I won't be.
Who says you have to stop?
I think I have to stop. Doesn't lead me anywhere. It's pointless. It's the dumbest dream. So he is in a hot rod, which I hate saying this is an American, but I'm like, bro, I don't know what British hot rod culture is like. I think you're like being an American poser. You know, the Amaribu of the Beatles was John Lennon. That's a pun about anime fans being weeboos.
You know, Paul liked the Beach Boys. This isn't quite a Little Deuce Coupe, but it's pretty darn close to that. You know, it's got hot rod flames. In his dreams, Paul thinks he's very cool. He wears a Hawaiian shirt and he drives a sick hot rod.
That has a phone and has a computer that is so close to being an interesting idea. Like,
basically, the computer is like Palm Pilot, like basically like a digital assistant, just like a calendar, basically. That's really all we've seen the computer do is be a calendar. It seems like such, to the modern eye, it's like, really, that's all you're going to have in your car is a calendar that talks to you? What a waste. But like in 1984, that's like, oh, that's sci-fi nonsense. You're never going to have that.
Yes. Yeah, so future. It's weird. It's definitely weird. And then he gets that's just wild. I find everything about the fact that somebody had to program this and that people at the time are like, whoa, they believe this is real. But then we know this is like all programmed. That's just doing this. If we think about this logistically working, somebody had to have programmed this calendar with all of like the fun fonts and put this in so that Paul knows exactly what he's doing today, like the day before. And that's hilarious.
I like how the word bulletin up in the top left.
Isn't that great?
It's like using the entire palette of like the 8-bit graphics that are available. You get to see every color. Basically, you had like a palette of so many colors that your computer could display on screen at one time. Your computer still technically has that limitation, but now the limitation is like a million colors. Back then, your limitation was you could have 8. I would say that the palette is probably closer to like Commodore.
Oh, okay.
And I wonder if this terminal is maybe Commodore based. I couldn't tell you what this computer is actually based on or what they cannibalized to make it. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of that the British had a lot of really small 8-bit computer manufacturers that we didn't get over here, like Acorn, and they had like the ZX Spectrum and stuff, and we never got any of that.
It's funny you should mention that, because guess what, listeners? We will probably have to return to this particular thing many times, because there's a book and there is a game.
I have picked up the Commodore 64 game port of Give My Regards to Broad Street. I haven't looked into it at all. I have to imagine it is a frustrating pickup thing, go to place adventure game. Look forward to that.
It sounds like it's an extended side quest of this movie.
This whole movie's a side quest. So Paul pulls over because he's a great guy. He gets a phone call. He pulls over and Brian is on the phone with him. He's like, you got to get here. He's like, yeah, I'm coming. It's cool, man. It's cool. No, listen, Harry. You know Harry? Yeah, I know Harry. Well, he's gone missing and he has the tapes.
So fun thing about this. If you know who Harry's actor is, he does appear in the very beginning of this movie. So on rewatches, you can be like, whoa, why is Harry vacuuming at the headquarters? And it's because it's a dream. That's why. So Paul, in a dash, is like, I need to get back to headquarters. And we get
to where he once belonged.
We get one of the worst snubs on the soundtrack, where we get this George Martin like arrangements, because there's a lot of funny arrangements. Also, one of the original songs that has two different versions on this album kind of comes from this really wacky, like Seinfeld-y bass riff that just keeps playing a lot. And you hear it a lot, but I wanted to bring that up because that bass is so obnoxious. But there's some fun little music. So you're like, what happens? How does Paul get back fast? Well, did you know? And we brought it up already. He's in a hot rod.
Did you know that hot rods can break the laws of reality and physics and run at like 4 times speed on normal roads?
And guess what? The movie is literally sped up at 4 times speed to give that effect. Yep.
It's pretty cool.
Also, I hate that once again, since this is a dream, they could have given a better opportunity to actually make the scene a little bit more fun. But they do give us at least one fun scene where he almost kills some old ladies. But he does at one point, after doing some crazy driving, put his arm around the passenger seat, showing how cash driver he is. So we weirdly, he's actually more concerned when he's driving out in the country than when he's in London.
That's true. That's interesting.
This is the coolest Paul will be in this whole movie. It's one of his cool moments. This is where Cool Dream Paul is just the coolest. But now we will seriously talk about the business meeting, Paul. We get introduced to our quote-unquote antagonist, whose name is Wrath, which... I know you might be thinking, you know what? It's similar to the person who runs our agency whose name is also threatening sounding. Don't worry about it at all.
Don't worry about it. Why are you trying to draw conclusions between this movie and our actual life that happened? That's really weird. You should maybe get a hobby. So Mr. Wrath is a man with intimidating dark sunglasses. He's kind of like Slugworth in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. He's just kind of a tall, thin man who looks threatening.
Yeah.
He never speaks, but he's got his cronies, and Paul has his lawyers, I guess. And they're like, listen, Paul, you got to get these tapes back. They're worth $6 million, Paul. If you lose them, we're out of business. Mr. Wrath will own us and your kids and, I don't know, your dog. So you got to find it. I want to focus for a minute on that $6 million figure, okay?
Okay.
There have been a lot of sales of music that's recorded in recent history. There have been expensive vinyl records. There have been expensive cassette tapes. Reel-to-reel, like master tapes, like 30-inch per second tapes, can be quite valuable. There have only been a couple of instances where that sort of thing has been more than $6 million. It's really hard to quantify that because all of those sales were made in the 21st century. So like, you know, with inflation, it's really hard to gauge that. If the tapes are like the tapes for the Broad Street album, where it's just Paul doing Beatles covers?
There's original songs on this album. What are you talking about?
Oh yeah, there's two.
And okay, two of those songs are the same song but slightly different. How dare you? And then one of them is if John was alive at this point, be like, this is grandpa music because it's literally like lounge music.
I don't think anyone in 1984 would pay $6 million for this tape. I don't get it. I just don't see it. I can't reason that.
You say that we're not that far away from the Great Betrayal, one of the most significant events in Paul's life.
The MJ betrayal, yeah.
But that because of that, we are still like, you know, Pipes of Peace had just released, Say, big record. So Paul is still a big commodity. So maybe that's why.
I guess, yeah. You know, I don't have a lot of data, contemporary data of like tapes that sold, because like a lot of that was very underground.
Yeah. I wonder exactly, because like for how I understand records, like so Wrath may have like helped them like supply some money.
He's not the record label. He's an outside force. There's a scene later on where Paul and Brian are like bickering in the dressing room, and Paul's like, what's the deal with this Wrath guy? Who let you bring him on? And Brian's like, well, we needed money and he had money, so we took his money and now he expects things of us.
And it's dumb because Paul has a lot of money, I'm guessing, by this point of his career.
So much money. Like, even if you consider the true fact that he was majorly ripped off with the rights to most of his Beatles stuff, he was making oodles of money off of his Wings stuff.
Yeah, 100%. And it's just weird, because like, it seems like, because in a scene later on in the movie, I guess we'll kind of talk about it now, he has like a fantasy, because he has like these weird fantasies going out on throughout most of the movie, where he fantasizes where there's like a newspaper that says artist lost everything. So if this fails, he will lose all of his wealth, which I find at this point, Paul is too big to fail. So I think that's one of the problems of this. And that's why
I think so.
This whole plot line, this is a dream as well, is really frustrating, because like Paul in interviews said, this is like a day in life of a superstar. This is not what this movie is in any way, shape or form. This is like an exaggerated weirdo, because we haven't got to like what the vast majority of this movie is. Like after this point, we barely get story. Like, barely any story happens after this point.
And I would like to stress that we've set up the plot of this movie. There is a missing thing. You must retrieve missing thing by midnight or else consequences. And Paul spends like no time looking for the thing that will impact the rest of his life. Surely he could clear his schedule and look for the thing a little harder.
And you know what's even crazier is that literally at the end of the movie, he's like, where was the last time that somebody saw him? And And there's a heavy implication that I don't get if, like, if it's Paul, like, this is a different time they remember, but it's not because he has the tapes. So this is like from last night. Paul was there like the last time they saw him, and no one ever thinks of going to that point until the end of this movie. And I'm not going to lie to you, listeners. There's also another spoiler I can give you. Paul is not physically in the building with the tapes at midnight. And I find if I was a person named Wrath, that I would not allow. I would be like, you don't have, the tapes aren't here. So why are we trusting you that you have the tapes?
They show this close-up of the clock.
Yeah.
And it's like 11:59. And first of all, Paul calls not the lawyers in the office at midnight. He calls Ringo,
who doesn't pick up because they're having a listening party
with Linda and the reporter who's played by Ringo's wife. So Ringo's schmoozing with the wives and he calls their place like, yeah, we got the tapes. Oh, and we got Harry too. Who cares? But we got them. And then he's like, yeah, you guys call the lawyers, let them know. And it's midnight. They're about to sign the contract and they call the lawyers and they hang up the phone and Brian is like, well, boys, we got the tapes. But there's no proof that they got the tapes. Like, no, absolutely not.
It's just weird. Like the fact that he calls and, also, he calls driving in his car. That's like the scene that's most offensive.
That's true. He didn't pull over this time.
You know, if he was drunk driving, he may not have seen Venice. What does that mean? I don't know. It might be a hint for a future listen. He could have had Harry do it. But also, we should mention something about Harry, where I don't know what this part of Harry's character is important, is that Harry is a former convict, unlike the Australian who has convict in his blood.
I guess that's the point in the movie, is to cast doubt. Like, oh, maybe Harry really did steal the tapes because he has a history of doing naughty things. But like, Paul is like defending him the whole movie, saying, nah, Harry's a good guy. He's great. No, he wouldn't do that.
And they bring it up in this meeting with Wrath in the beginning of the movie. Like, they already know that, like, Paul is like, nah, he's fine. He's fine. He's one of us.
Kind of repeat that throughout several scenes in the movie, and it gets old. So we won't belabor the point. But Paul thinks Harry is good. And yeah, spoiler alert, he was. So instead of looking for the $6 million master tapes to this album, which is going to be imminently released, it's already on pre-order.
Already has like 6 million sales or something.
Five or 6 million in pre-sales. Yeah. He decides, you know what? I have a schedule. My computer told me I'm going to the studio at 10:30, so I'm going to the studio. And we get to meet Ringo.
And my favorite part of this, every song except two songs, I guess four, which are Goodnight Princess, No More Lonely Nights, Ballad, No More Lonely Nights, play out version, and Long and Winding Road are the only songs that he doesn't record. The rest of what is on this soundtrack will be played in this movie during this sequence, and that is what will be released on the soundtrack of this movie. So they basically re-record the tapes, even though Ringo's like, I don't want to re-record the tapes. They literally re-record everything that is on this album, and it is so weird as a concept.
And I know it's never clearly established that they're re-recording the songs for the missing album. We kind of have to assume that's what they're doing, because the only alternative is that they're recording songs for a new album, which should not be their priority since they are missing the $6 million album. Whatever the case, Paul walks into the studio. We get some cameos from Jeff Emmerich and George Martin.
And then Ringo is there. And then Ringo, going back to the doubting thing, even brings up Harry's like that. And like, Harry's like, oh, why'd you hire that convict? And I'm like,
yeah, Ringo doesn't believe in Harry at all. Ringo's like, yeah, he's a crook. He probably stole the tapes.
I just want to apologize. Not all Australians are convicts. I was trying to be funny earlier. It wasn't funny. I'm sorry, Australians. I don't know if you know this, but there's like a thing that Ringo does not want to record, like redo any of these covers. He's like, I'm not going to be anything on the Beatles. But on the soundtrack version of this, there on Good Day Sunshine, there is an outtake where from this conversation where he's like, where he's kind of talking to Paul, where he's like, oh, Harry. And it's like, so technically he didn't want to appear on a track, but guess what? On the soundtrack he does. So technically he's playing. Am I right?
Let me ask you this. Does the medley of Yesterday, Here, There, and Everywhere, and Wanderlust, is that all one contiguous track on the soundtrack?
No.
No? Is it split up into separate tracks?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Then yeah, no. Then
Paul betrayed Ringo.
He did. I mean, I guess Ringo doesn't drum on these tracks, but there's really not a lot of drumming on these versions of these tracks. Well, I guess Good Day Sunshine has drums. But that's just a thought. Paul's betrayal. So this medley's weird because you're like, oh, so is there a lot of medleys? No, there is just straight songs. Every other song after this point is
pretty faithful re-recording of the studio take. So the next like four or five songs that you're going to see, and there's going to be plot interspersed, but I'm just going to quickly get the songs out of the way. They're basically structured as like diegetic. Okay, now it's time for us to film the music video for this song.
Yeah.
We get that with Ballroom Dancing. We get that with Silly Love Songs. Yeah. I think that's what we get with the songs in the warehouse. Yeah. With the
Not Such a Bad Boy, So Bad, No Values.
Yep. Yep. Now, you know, throughout all of this, first of all, I think the Ballroom Dancing sequences is actually kind of visually very interesting and fun because it's got this dance, like a ballroom dance, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe even a ballroom blitz.
Yeah.
And then like Paul goes all West Side Story and like the greasers break in and start picking fights.
This version of the song is on the soundtrack, and you may not pay attention to this that much. So all of the random direction that Paul gives to actors in this is also on the soundtrack to this, where it's like, all right, kids, moving along. Move it along. So you hear him just giving directions at random points in the song. So he's like, I get to be a director of this particular sequence. Big cameo in the sequence is John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin shows up. So that is my answer to that. This is the second location we've had since we left the headquarters. So Ballroom Dancing, we have kind of made this a meme amongst the two of us, where every once in a while I might just text Dylan Ballroom Dancing. Because like the way there's like different ways that Paul says ball. He's like, boom. Ballroom dancing. Everybody's like, ballroom dancing. This is the most music video-y of all of the songs. At times it feels like a normal thing, but then like when the dancers who are like the West Side Story type of people kind of come in, like the greasers, it feels like that's not part of it. But then on rewatch, I'm like, no, this is just the music video. This is how it's supposed to be. This is all part of the construct of what this video is. This is not anything other than what it is. Like this and the next one are the one that are most structured like a normal video, but this one is really elaborate.
Yeah, I will say it's very unrealistic that as it's presented in the film, it's basically they do this music video in one take.
Yeah.
Which that would never happen. You would splice so many takes together. Yeah. to get what you're looking for. And I'm sure that's what they actually did in the movie. But, you know, again, if this is a day in the life of a superstar, Paul McCartney, showing, oh yeah, I just, I'm a superstar. I just knocked out, you know, three music videos in three different locations. You know, I'm great.
So
he's just so good.
He's just so good. Yeah. And I just don't get this because it's just like, is this Paul like bragging about how good he is like at this? And it's such a strange idea. Starting now, we do get a lot of songs where Ringo is actually playing on the soundtrack. He might not have been on the original songs, but Ringo is now playing on the songs. Like starting with Wanderlust, which was the last song before this, he is now actually drumming on these. He dresses up for this song. He kind of looks like a 50s person. He will not dress up for the next song. We'll keep that on hold because
they gotta have lunch first. They gotta eat.
Because they're at, and this is where this movie is, maybe Paul just loves movies because there's just so many B movie references. But before that, this is a movie studio, and that's why it's like this. There's this interesting exchange. It's probably a normal exchange that Paul has all the time. Dream Paul is kind of like woke Paul because he's kind of a jerk to this old man who's like, my wife likes you, but I don't like you, but you're here, so I'm gonna make you sign my autograph for my wife. And he's like, F off, old man.
But he still signs it, so, you know, he's not that rude.
When I'm 64, I wouldn't be a jerk to a young, hot celebrity like me, Paul McCartney, who is young and hot. The girl is mine. I can compete with Michael Jackson. Deal with it, old man. Real Paul thought this sequence was very important.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know what it says about the real Paul McCartney and his interactions with fans. I mean, it's been often said that of the Beatles, like, Paul was the least able to maybe take a joke at his own expense.
Yeah.
And maybe part of this movie is, like, trying to shed some of that. I don't know.
This movie hurt Paul. Like, I think he really believed in this movie. There is so much of him out there, like, interviews. He went on Johnny Carson. He really tried with this movie to get it to work.
Yeah.
And at the studio, they also reference, which we'll have to watch as well, Zippity-Doo-Dah, Zippity-Day. Had to talk about Song of the South because, yay, racist Disney film. Yay. It's on the soundtrack, but as a reprise for Silly Love Songs that appears when they're at the next location. Also at this location, this is where we're introduced to Ringo's reporter wife, who's doing a story about music.
She plays like no actual role in the movie, so
Ringo rizzes her up. For old people, that means he basically used his charm and she was smitten with him right away. To be fair, Ringo is a really good part of this movie. Paul is trying to contain how awesome Ringo is in this movie.
In his dreams, Paul sees Ringo as a charismatic doofus.
Yeah, but Ringo also does do acting things where it feels like he's doing theater and doing improv stuff that definitely wasn't in that, because he has like a lot of these really random lines where he talks to characters and asks them like how your life is going, where he's like, oh, how's the new house? And he's like, you know, it's so cold in here. What are we, Canadians?
Well, he's a professional. I mean, he was in Caveman, he was. For Christ's sake. I mean, you got to respect him.
You do. You know how much professional he was? He's like, I do not want to have any hand in what you're about to do next, Paul. I don't get what the purpose of this sequence is. And if you've probably seen any footage of this movie, this is what you've seen, because it is the weirdest thing. So it's the 80s. Space Age Love Song by Flock of Seagulls has come out. So Paul's like, you know, space is cool again. You know, we have nostalgia for the 60s. So let's basically not change anything about Silly Love Songs and do Silly Love Songs again, which is bold, like really bold, as one of your biggest songs that you're just going to do it again with barely any changes.
It's got the same weird wacky percussion in the beginning, yeah, where it sounds like all industrial and then it just goes into the song. Like, it's exactly the same. And yeah, they look like they're all in like clown white, yep, and they've all got like these weird, like, you know, dark outlines in their eyes and like stark white wigs. They almost look like Kiss in space.
Yeah,
a little bit.
I hate saying, because Linda kind of has a robotic aspect to her, even though I think Linda is like objectively like my favorite part of Silly Love Songs. Like her like parts where she's just randomly saying, don't you see, dun dun dun, like those parts I really like when Linda comes in. But the way that Linda acts, like she goes full robot, like kind of went in this, like she is like these really tense eyes where it's like, can't you see? You can't see us listeners, but I was trying to give Dylan these like really intense eyes. He keeps looking away from me.
You know who does go full robot? The weird random moonwalking robot dancer in front of the band.
You mean the Michael Jackson stand-in? Because I watched a video that theorized that was a Michael Jackson stand-in.
I mean, he moonwalks, so I mean, and at this time, like you said, Paul and MJ were still besties, so I think so.
Imagine if MJ was in this. So yeah, that would have been crazy. He also does like crazy acrobatic jumps that like breaks the laws of reality. Maybe that was a hint that this is a dream.
No, I think the first major hint is that Paul is cool and drives a hot rod. That doesn't track.
There is so little to say about the scene except it is such ridiculousness. Like some people make, oh, the breakdancer is silly. And I'm like, the idea that they're dressed like this for no reason is the silliest part of this.
The visual contrast with the entire rest of the film is, it's stark and it's bizarre.
I'm not going to lie, it's shot weird too. Like once the breakdancer comes on, like the breakdancer's just in front of them, and the way the stage is set up, it's just weird. Cause
yeah, it's just in like full dead on wide shot.
Yeah, and it also feels like the stage is way behind him, too. It's strange. Do you have anything else to say about it?
No.
Okay, so there are some things we missed in the recap. So Paul has had these, like, flashbacks with, like, Harry, or he's in, like, a bar, and there's some, like, really corny joke, where he's, like, saying, I don't have knives and stuff. He's like, I'm not a thief. I'm not that like that anymore. And Paul's like, bro, right, you want a job? And I'm like, Paul, I just don't, maybe this isn't the reason why this is a fantasy, even though in the real world you also hired this guy.
I think, you know what? I think that sequence, I think, because, you know, sometimes when you're dreaming, you do have thoughts, semi-lucid thoughts about real things that have occurred, mm-hmm, and like your real circumstances. So I think in the context of this movie, like him talking to Harry and giving him a job, I think that conversation actually happened in real life. And that's dream Paul kind of half remembering it while he's asleep.
I agree.
There's a woman. She's concerned for Harry. She doesn't know where Harry is either.
She wasn't at the Broad Street station that they say goodbye to him and where he eventually goes. So that whole thing is confusing. Why?
Everybody has terrible like judgment and amnesia about Harry's whereabouts.
Yeah. There's also another fantasy that happens.
I like this fantasy where, because it's got like a doom and gloom instrumental version of Silly Love Songs that plays in the background, and I love it.
Is this the one the dogs are chasing him?
Yeah.
You know, we come from America where when we see cops in our media, they are not going to allow like a guy 4 feet in front of them like to just run away like that. And there's dogs. They have attack dogs that are literally meant to attack them. They have maximum force. Police dogs are scary, but I think this is about almost all dogs. But police dogs in particular are very scary. Why don't they just shoot him?
Well, there might be a risk of a stray shot could damage the goods, and that would be a greater risk.
That's true. Also, there are these like cop characters that after a certain point are just dropped from this movie. Like, they're at this studio, they'll be at one of the other locations, they'll go back to the headquarters, then we'll never see them again, and they never do their job. Cops, all right? Yeah, that trace sequence is dumb. It's so silly. Like, once again, it's a fantasy. Also, in like this sequence too at the studio, there's a bunch of like random B movie, and like there's like a Star Wars reference, and it's just a bunch of big B movie references. It's trying to show up. Paul's like, I know what stuff. I know what B movies are. I know what film is. I'm Paul McCartney.
I've seen a Star Wars. I'm cool.
I've seen a Star Wars. Moving on. So we go to our next location, which is objectively the most boring location of this whole movie. The song, like, because this is like the first time where we get our first batch of like non-cover songs.
And I mean, basically, this whole set basically exists as a location where Paul can talk to a guy.
Apologies. While recording this run through, I ended up calling Giant Haystack, Big Haystack. Major mistake. Apologies on that, but really couldn't find a way of correcting it really well.
Who can kind of threaten him a little bit, kind of be like, hey, I want to buy your tapes.
Yeah.
And Paul's like, no. And he can kind of half-heartedly make efforts at looking for his tapes. Like, by the way, have you seen Harry? And big guy's like, no. Paul's like, okay, cool. Let me know if you see him.
This is also a former wrestler turned actor, much like the Big Show. That has nothing to do with anything. Like, we conveniently also know a wrestler. This guy is also named Big Haystacks, a British wrestler that's probably big in Britain. We're Yanks, so we don't know these things. British fans.
I don't even know American wrestlers. You know, except the one that we know personally.
The Big Show.
He's our best friend.
Yeah, the Big Show. Yeah.
Even,
and like, he has a pickup. So, and like, the pickup gets damaged.
Yeah, and it's left-hand drive as well, I just realized. So he must have imported it from the States.
Yeah.
I have a lot of problems with this movie. Here's one of them. All right, they're going to this industrial warehouse to shoot some more videos and release some more songs, right? So they're going there. They have a fleet of 3 Rolls Royces and 1 crappy-ass van. And which car do you think Paul is riding in?
And you're also wondering, where is the hot rod? I'm also wondering that as well, because it's going to go to the next location. Also, the car damages the truck.
And the wrestler is not happy about that.
He's not.
He nearly slugs the van driver. We should also state that throughout the goings-on in the film, Wrath and crew have been following. Like, sometimes you just see his little black sports car, like, in the background of scenes.
Yeah.
But then sometimes, like, they'll walk up to where Paul was sitting, and Paul will, like, stand up and run away, skirting responsibilities. Wrath's just being like, hey buddy, where's the tapes? I really want to see them. And Paul's just like, oh, gotta go.
I think my favorite scene is when they're still at like the movie studio and Brian like interacts with them, and like the music is so intense and goes, ah, like, stop asking us, you'll get what your tapes. And then when they're at the next location, and I almost feel like this is filmed out of order, where he's like more accommodating to them. He's like, we'll be fine, like, we'll meet you there. And it's like, why are you now nicer to them after you're a jerk to them? Maybe he realized that mistakes of his ways.
That's interesting. Maybe that was shot in a different order.
Oh, once again, I'm annoyed with the soundtrack having weird isms in it, where on no value at all, it ends in like a flashback where he imagines Harry basically selling the tapes to Big Haystacks. This is before he talks to Big Haystacks, who seems like a nice dude, who I think is maybe hired by Wrath. It's implied, but I don't know. Maybe Big Haystacks is a friend, much like the Big show is to us. So I just don't know. It's very confusing. I don't think our friend would have sold the tapes to Big Show. Because even though the Big Show is like, you know, podcast recordings sell really well in Europe. And I'm like, okay. Because that's where a bunch of Beatle fans are. But no, I don't want to do that. Because like Big Haystacks also does a very similar thing where he's like, these bootlegs sell really well in America. So if you give me that, like, and he's like, no, we don't do that now. Like, they're all like, it's all legal now. There's all a good system. And I'm like, I said the same thing to the Big Show. It's weird. Just saying. Moving on from that, we go to our next location. So I want us to remember that we have now been to three different venues. So we have recorded Yesterday, Here, There, and Everywhere, Wanderlust, Ballroom Dancing, Silly Love Songs, Not Such a Bad Boy, No Value, all in one take, it seems like, unless they're cutting out all the times where they don't do it, which is impressive how good they are doing things in one take. So then we go to the BBC, and the BBC are kind of jerks, not gonna lie. They give me bad vibes.
It's weird. Like, Paul goes and sits down for an interview. It's like a short fluff, like, in between songs, basically. And they cut the interview, and then the reporter's like, ugh, interviews, am I right? And it's like, what? This is your job. What are you doing?
Yeah. But then we go to probably the best cover of the whole movie, 401. Yeah, I think the song's great. But now we have to get to the Eleanor Rigby dream sequence, which is equal parts the best in part of the movie for 30 seconds or about a minute. The beginning part of Eleanor Rigby is great because it's the only part of the movie where it feels like you're in a dream, and it's interesting, and I like the imagery a lot. So Paul is just in a studio, and there's just some really good cutting where it cuts to him, it cuts to the people in the booth, and like it cuts back and then like cuts to them again, and they're now in like suits, like wearing bow ties and a black suit, and then it cuts to Paul's head and pulls out, he's also in a suit, and everyone else is around him, and I think they're at the Albert Hall. And I love the imagery of this because like it also gets a little echoey as well in the recording, and I like that the control board is right next to the stage, and the control board looks really unnatural right next to the stage, and it's just really surreal. And then like everyone in the movie is now also in like has their own box at the Albert Hall, and they're just like kind of surrounding him, and it's really intense and it's really cool.
It's definitely the tightest bit of cinematography.
And if more of the movie was like this, like that's like, this is like what we had with the Magical Mystery Tour, which is the last thing that Paul had major power over, and this feels like a Magical Mystery Tour thing. And I'm just surprised that there wasn't more of this, because this is like what Paul knows. But then have, you know, I thought Anthology, wow, it's really cool that there's an instrumental version of Eleanor Rigby. What I didn't know is that there already was an extended instrumental version of Eleanor Rigby that is 6 minutes longer, and it's one of the weirdest parts of this movie because it's an extended dream sequence within a dream sequence.
It all takes place in like presumably like kind of Victorian era, very Pride and Prejudice.
Very Pride and Prejudice. You know? It has that very Jane Austen kind of aesthetic. Like it kind of begins with like the rural countryside, and eventually we end up in London, and like Rath is there. Paul has these like sideburns that are just the ugliest thing I've ever seen Paul have. He just looks like a dork. Ringo looks cool, but Ringo always looks cool.
I don't think the sideburns look that bad on him, sort of in the context of the dream sequence. I think if we had to see him like that throughout the entire film, I would probably have a problem with it. But, you know, contextualized with his little outfit, I think it's all right.
I disagree with you completely. Like, I just think Paul looks like a dork throughout this whole sequence. I've seen the sequence a lot. So, boom, roasted. I don't even think you rewatched it today.
I did rewatch it. How dare you?
So basically, like, Ringo's wife is there, Barbara, Ringo, and Linda, and they're going to, like, a picnic, and then eventually Harry shows up. So, like, the tapes finally appear in what they are, where they're glowing. Rath shows up. Rath looks really awesome.
Oh, yeah. I love his little beady, like, super small sunglasses.
Oh, he looks so cool. And they give him kind of, like, a goatee. He looks really cool in this flashback. He looks like a Victorian villain. Surprise, surprise.
And then he takes out his badass sword cane.
Oh, you're forgetting the most important thing. Linda, Barbara.
What, showing up as a Madonna visage?
No, she's dead. They fall off the waterfall.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and that
yeah.
scene is funny. Tragic. As heck. Like, they look like they're just like, the way they fall off this waterfall, like, there's a waterfall here? Surprising they miss this waterfall. It's so obvious that there's a waterfall there.
And then they just start waving at Paul like, oh no, it's a waterfall, help us. And Paul's like, you idiots.
He's like, no. And there's like a scene where Linda shows up as like the Madonna. She kind of rocks it, I'm not gonna lie. And then she kind of sings like, all the lonely people. Like the ethereal type of sound they have for that. That's kind of cool. But then we're in London. It feels like Jack the Ripper times. This is like evil Harry doing evil Harry things. But then like...
scheming with pro wrestlers.
Harry dies like on some steps.
They play the Psycho theme when they stab him.
That's right, they do. Off brand.
Oh, it's... Paige asked me, is that the Psycho theme?
Yeah. Oh, also, if you're wondering how Paul's acting this movie has been, I'm not going to be mean. He's just wooden, really.
Yeah, he's a bit stiff. Like he's... I've definitely seen worse from, you know, big name like people who don't typically do movies.
I watched Purple Rain as well after one of these things because they came out in the same year. And I think there's worse acting in Purple Rain. It's just that Prince is like the opposite of Paul, where Paul is like so guarded that he's uninteresting. Where Prince is like the exact opposite, where he's guarded, but he's very interesting. Because like Prince is mysterious and Paul does not have any, like you almost feel like you know exactly who Paul is.
Yeah. And Paul really doesn't have much in the way of like emotional range in this movie. For the most part, he's just a chill guy.
Yeah.
Like there's that one bit where he's in the dressing room yelling at Brian, and yelling is putting it pretty strongly.
Yeah.
They're having a conversation where they're probably talking a little louder than they would because Paul is supposed to be a little annoyed. That's about as much range as you get. Otherwise, Paul's just like, oh yeah, no, everything's cool. We'll get the tapes, whatever. Let's break for lunch.
Yeah. And I mean, like in Purple Rain, like all the performances in that are just so over the top. And there's actually a story. It's just so baffling that we are this far in. And if you're confused by this movie, just know that most of this is obstructed by so many stupid songs being included in this movie that have no reason to be in this movie because they make make any sense why he's just recording all of these things, especially because like he has the tapes done. Why are they doing this again?
I would be very curious to know how much movie would remain if you were to just cut out the songs.
I think like 20-30 minutes, to be perfectly honest with you. I think that might be on the higher end of estimating. Maybe.
I mean, granted, that's probably true of a lot of like musical movies. Calling this a musical movie is generous. But like, in theory, if you've got less dialogue, you've got less screenplay time, you know, you can tighten it up and make it really impactful. And that just doesn't feel like what's happened here. It's a vehicle to move from song to song.
Yeah, because our next sequence we get up, the only part of the movie where Paul is not performing the songs, they're just playing. It's like a Miami Vice like pacing thing where you have to have music over the travel. Because like we get, I think it's where we kind of hear Another Lonely Night for the first time. Oh, also this is when the Hot Rod finally comes back because he wakes up from the dream and we're now, the Hot Rod is back somehow. And now Paul's like, where he's always like, I'm going out. And then we get something that's on the soundtrack, which is Band on the Run. And then I think after that, it kind of goes to Another Lonely Night and the ballad version that has David Gilmour on it. David Gilmour kind of slays on it. No More Lonely Nights, both versions I think are excellent songs. They're good. So
do you think the fact that Paul didn't re-record Band on the Run, like he used the original studio recording, do you think that's because he's really satisfied with that recording, or do you think he just ran out of time or interest in the project to re-record it?
And I think a lot of this sequence, when I was saying that like, oh yeah, like 20-30 minutes, so this is the part of the movie where this actually is movie part of movie, because this is now just him driving around, which is technically the actual locating of the tapes. This is where the detective work goes. We have songs over it, so technically it's no longer him performing and just doing stuff. It is now songs that are playing over it for pacing issues, so we have a nice thing to listen to,
right?
And I think Band on the Run, because he's like, I'm going out, that just made sense for that particular sequence.
Also, it should be noted, like, per the timeline of this film, when he leaves this next location that he's getting to, it's 11:30 at night. It is late in the evening, and he's just started looking for these tapes.
I mean, he does stop. Okay, We're talking about after he stops at the Monkey Man and the Tweeter in the Monkey Man's house. Yeah.
Yeah. When he leaves Monkey Man, yeah. It's 11:30.
It's really late. And there is a sequence we get like in the car. He remembers, give my regards to Broad Street and everywhere.
So he remembers it once before in the movie, and I don't remember where it happens the first time. But after he leaves the Monkey Man, which, you know, we can talk about briefly here, but as he's driving away, he sees a bunch of signs for Broad Street Station, and then he's like, oh, of course, Harry said he was going to Broad Street, and we sang him a song, and we saw him off. Now Paul's like, maybe I should check Broad Street.
Yeah, and the guy he stopped at is a big actor. We, from what we understand, his name is Ralph Richardson. He's a big stage actor. This is one of the last things he records. He has a monkey. It's so random, but, you know, maybe he's trying to reference everybody's got something to hide except for me and my monkey, except he has nothing to hide here. Before we go to Broad Street, we get another song, which is Long and Winding Road, which is so obvious, but I have a lot of problems with this version of Long and Winding Road.
It reeks of hypocrisy.
Not a big fan of Phil Spector. Nobody really should be, because he did murder somebody, but like, he does not like his version of Let It Be.
So yeah, this version of the Long and Winding Road, it's got this smooth sax intro that my wife said sounds like the Down on Main Street riff little bit, which I totally do hear. And it's like, yeah, like Paul hated Phil Spector's like Let It Be so much that he made the naked version, right? That was all stripped down and was like au naturel. But I guess in the 80s, he's like, no, you know what? Phil Spector didn't cheese this up enough. We gotta...
It had a saxophone.
I don't get it.
It's so weird. It's not the most contrived part of this movie. And we've already kind of referenced this contrived part of the movie. This is so contrived that every time I see it, I am just confused that there is a box that says, steal me. For God's sake, steal me. When he works at the same station, he's all sad. He sits on a bench. Oh, he's already on the bench. And then he looks over. There's the case.
He sits on a wet bench. It is raining. Paul now has a soggy butt.
That's kind of the metaphor of this whole movie. And he sees the tapes.
In a bright blue box, sitting on a bench in a popular railway station, the box of the tape says Paul McCartney master tape on it in big Sharpie. And it's just been sat there for a full day.
And if you're wondering too, then there's a guy going, oh, oh. And you're like, nobody heard this as well. Are you serious? And we find that Harry has been stuck in like, I'm probably guessing like
some sort of utility shed.
And it feels like somebody who's working at the railway station maybe should have done something with this, cleaning up the custodial station. Broad Street Station doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I wonder if Broad Street Station was kind of a rat infested and like nobody gave two craps about it. And that's like A, why it was torn down a few years later, but B, like why nobody cared that Harry was stuck, because it's like a trash station.
Correct us, listeners, if we're wrong on this. I do think that they knew it was going to be torn down by this point. So maybe that's why it's like it.
Yeah, maybe.
And then like Harry like comes out and stabs Paul. And yeah, that's how the dream ends.
the end. Oh man, what a different movie that would have been. Unfortunately, that's not actually what happens. So Harry says, oh, thank God you found the tapes, Paul. Yeah, I'm in the shed. I thought it was the toilet. I've been stuck in here for 24 hours. I probably reek of piss. Whoopsie poopsie. And everything's fine.
Up until that moment, like the music is really tense. And then Paul's like, and then Harry also starts laughing.
Yeah, they have a weird laugh, and then they start like skipping, and Paul's like, Paul is super cool. Again, this is how you know it's Dream Paul. He like slides down the stairs. Paul slides down the railing of the stairs. So cool.
Also, I'm thinking about this again. The Australian guy, he should have been Harry, and this guy shouldn't have been Harry. I'm kidding. He's fine. It's just that Paul has no chemistry with this guy. Like every exchange they've had in this movie is really awkward.
I think all of these people, like in the movie, you know, aside from like the members of his band and, you know, Ringo and Barbara, I think they're all like actors. I wonder if the movie maybe could have been improved if Paul could have like actually like gotten more of his like friends to like do it. Like, I don't think they would have agreed to it.
No.
But maybe that would have made the film better, because the chemistry would have been better. Because like, even we've talked about Paul's stiff acting, but like his conversations with Ringo seemed a little marginally less stiff than like his conversations with quote unquote Brian
Brian, the record exec, you know?
But yeah, I just think like Harry, if they would have had someone more smarmy, or maybe they just could have had the Rath character be the guy that stole the tapes. He would have been awesome stealing the tapes.
That would have been a very like predictable, like you probably would have seen it coming a mile away, but I think it would have been stronger.
You're like, yeah, that guy definitely did stuff in the past.
He's still doing stuff actively. Yeah. You can tell.
So as I said earlier, like they don't arrive on time to get to the tapes. We already established that he calls Linda first and he doesn't get there and he doesn't face the consequences. That doesn't matter, even though it seems like the Rath character is a nice guy. Maybe that was the thing. You shouldn't judge Australians by their cover and you shouldn't judge the Rath character.
And then Paul wakes up. He finally escaped traffic. He's in the back of his Rolls Royce again. Hot Rod nowhere to be found. And his team says, hey, you're finally awake.
Do you remember the Skyrim intro? It's like that.
That's what I did.
Yeah. That's good. And then the movie ends and we get like the more synthy silly version of No More Lonely Nights. And that's kind of how it ends. Yeah, that's the movie. So what are our thoughts? If you watch this movie 8 times, it's charming. If you don't watch...
counter argument. Don't watch this movie 8 times. If you're gonna watch it once. It's fine as a curiosity. It's
bad the first time though. After you watch it the second time, you're like, maybe it's not that bad. You know, now that I know what's coming, it's not a bad movie anymore. But if you only watch it once, you'll just think it's a bad movie. And I feel like that's being mean, that on first impression it's just a bad movie.
But it kind of is. It's not a good movie.
I don't think it is. Purple Rain is a better movie. Yeah, it's literally nothing like this movie, but it came out in the same year. Yeah. If you watch this movie, you'll never have No More Lonely Nights, though, because you'll have Paul and his friends to sing songs to you and that have no value at all. And, you know, you might go into a state of wanderlust, and then maybe it might lead to a good day, sunshine. This movie is for no one. I don't know if I agree completely. Like, you know, sometimes I want to be just a bad boy. Eleanor Rigby. You know, sometimes we just want to have silly love songs, and it was long and winding. Any final thoughts?
If you find our missing laptop,
yeah,
please
send us an email at 2through8@gmail.com. 2through8@gmail.com. Please find it. And if you find an illicit version of this podcast that is not as good, that is posted on another account, that is not real, yeah, please do that. We desire it. We don't like the big show and the guy that Dylan got us into money problems with, like, is not happy with us. We would like to still continue releasing podcasts, which is what they want anyways, on our own terms.
Even if you don't find the laptop, if you have other comments that you'd like to share with us or recommendations for things we should talk about, let us know.
What are we talking about next?
Well, we are a little late on the bandwagon, but I think it's time we look at something that isn't strictly Beatles. We're going Beatles adjacent, and we are going
Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys.
So yeah, tune in next time where we'll discuss the Beach Boys' arguably most important and most influential album, and we'll see what we think about it.
I'm excited. And have a great day. But yeah, have a great night. Bye-bye.
Bye.